The growth of Oregon's prison population will slow during the next decade as more inmates complete serving mandatory minimum sentences and are released. Suzanne Porter, a forecaster in the Office of Economic Analysis, found that the prison population has grown by 75% since 1995, but predicted that it will increase by only a little over 21% in the next 9 years. The rate of growth in the 2005 to 2007 biennium will decline by 2013, according to Porter's projections. In a written analysis she prepared for a joint hearing of the Judiciary Committees in Roseburg on Wednesday, Porter said the driving force behind the growth of the prison population has been the passage of Measure 11, the 1994 initiative that imposed long mandatory minimum sentences for a large number of violent crimes and an expansion of the repeat property offenders law. Porter said that without the policy changes that were enacted by the legislature and by initiative, the state currently would need almost 5,000 fewer prison beds. But the numbers do not tell the whole story. With the nation turning away from rehabilitation and towards punishment, it's doubtful the released prisoners will ever be able to become contributing members of society. This from the Oregonian and other sources.
The tribe with Oregon's most profitable casino has offered to help another tribe build a casino on its reservation in central Oregon if it will drop plans to build one that taps the lucrative Portland area gambling market. But the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs are not likely to go for the offer. Projected revenues from a casino on the remote central Oregon reservation are projected to be far below those from their proposed casino in the Columbia Gorge town of Cascade Locks. Tribal advisors also say profits will be less than what the tribe needs to help its members out of poverty. The closest of 9 Oregon tribal casinos to Portland, the Grand Ronde Tribe's Spirit Mountain Casino, is the biggest and most profitable in the state and is Oregon's top tourist attraction. Len Bergestein, casino consultant to the Warm Springs Tribe, said only a casino near Portland would generate the more than $100 million needed to help the tribe's more than 4,000 members. The Grand Ronde has tried to build a casino in Portland, which is part of the area they occupied before they were forced onto a reservation and later disbanded by the federal government, but gave up when it became clear the state of Oregon would continue to oppose tribal casinos off current reservation lands.
The Oregon Board of Pharmacies has adopted a new position on filling prescriptions that will make it easier for women to secure emergency contraception. Oregon law allows pharmacists to refuse to fill prescriptions that challenge their moral beliefs, such as those for emergency contraception known as the morning after pill. But the pharmacy board voted that in such a case, patients must be provided with another way of receiving the medication in a timely manner. The pharmacy board statement also says that it's unprofessional for a pharmacist to lecture a patient on moral grounds or to destroy, confiscate, or otherwise tamper with any medication. Rebecca Green of Oregon Narrow, a pro-choice group, says the group is pleased with the new position.
The fight over Mike's Gulch, a steep slope of primarily Douglas fir trees lying in almost 400,000 acres of protected forest, opens a new front in the long-running battle over the nation's roadless areas. In July 2004, the administration reversed a Clinton-era rule that had made nearly 60 million acres of national forests off-limits to road building and development. The Forest Service is now pressing ahead with timber auctions in these areas. Logging companies have to ferry out the timber by helicopter. It remains to be seen whether any timber companies will submit the minimum bid for the first timber sale, which covers 350 acres. Although the auction is scheduled to go off tomorrow as planned, the Forest Service has agreed not to finalize the sale by awarding it, pending a hearing next Wednesday before the U.S. District Judge Owen Panner in Medford. Environmentalists and coalitions of outdoor sports enthusiasts are not giving up on this one. This from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
The U.S. Armed Forces disposed of chemical weapons in the ocean from World War I through 1970. At the time, it was thought that the vastness of ocean waters would absorb chemical agents that may leak from these weapons. However, public concerns about human health and environmental risks and the economic effects of potential damage to marine resources led to a statutory prohibition on the disposal of chemical weapons in the ocean back in 1972. For many years, there was little attention to weapons that have been dumped offshore prior to this prohibition. However, the U.S. Army completed a report in 2001 indicating that the past disposal of chemical weapons in the ocean had been more common and widespread geographically than previously acknowledged. The Army cataloged 74 instances of disposal through 1970, including 32 instances off U.S. shores and 42 off foreign shores. The disclosure of these records has renewed public concern about lingering risks from chemical weapons still in the ocean today. This from the American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy.
Alaskan state lawmakers have failed to agree on terms of an oil tax bill, a key component to bringing a proposed 3,600-mile natural gas pipeline closer to reality. The source of contention between the House and Senate was a single percentage point in the base rate of the tax on profits and how fast that rate would escalate as oil prices rise. The different versions of the bill went to a conference committee, and negotiators emerged with a compromise tax rate on the Alaska profits of oil companies. But the House rejected the compromise and adjourned. The bill died, as it did at the end of the regular session in May. The pipeline, at an estimated cost of $19 billion to Canada or $27 billion to Chicago, would be North America's largest ever construction project. The proposed tax would have replaced the state's current production tax system, which legislatures say is outdated and has resulted in large oil fields escaping or paying minimal taxes.
In Florida, they have special license plates you can buy to help save the manatees. Now it appears all the efforts are paying off because the State Wildlife Commission is voting to take the creatures off the endangered species list. The manatee isn't out of the woods, though. What are they doing in the woods anyway? The panel's vote designates the manatee as a threatened species, and officials say the change won't affect the way it's protected since manatees are still protected under federal law. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission also voted to remove the bald eagle from its threatened species list. The bald eagle is also under federal protection.
The first vaccine against cervical cancer will be available to girls as young as 9 later this month. Its manufacturer, Merck & Company, Incorporated, is already taking orders for Gardasil. The three-shot series costs $360. The newly approved vaccine works by preventing infection by four of the dozens of strains of the human papillomavirus, virus, or HPV, the most prevalent sexually transmitted disease. The Food and Drug Administration licensed it for use in girls and women 9 to 26. It's still being studied in males. Gardasil protects against the two types of HPV responsible for about 70% of cervical cancer cases. The vaccine also blocks infection by two other strains responsible for 9% of genital warts cases. Dr. Karen Rudick, president of American Cancer Society's FDA of the HPV vaccine, first seen targets specifically to fetal cancer, is one of the most important advances in women's health in recent years.
A federal court will soon decide whether two officials of the American Israel Public Committee, or APAC, mishandling classified information can proceed or whether it must dismiss First Amendment grounds. It'll be a fatal decision either way. If the prosecution is admitted to proceed, it would reflect unprecedented determination that private individuals who are not engaged in espionage can be punished for receiving and transmitting national defense information. Such a finding would instantly transform many national security reporters, researchers, and others into potential criminals. If the case is dismissed, it would imply a bold affirmation of the First Amendment values against the encroachment of a Justice Department that keeps testing its ever-expanding boundaries. This from the Truth Out website.
The death of Al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq came as more Americans than ever thought the war in Iraq was a mistake, according to AP-Ipsos polling. The poll, taken Monday through Wednesday, before news broke that U.S. forces had killed al-Zarqawi, found that 59% of adults say the United States made a mistake in going to war in Iraq, the highest level yet. Approval of President Bush's handling of Iraq dipped to 33%, a new low. His overall job approval was 35%. More than half the respondents said it's unlikely that a stable, democratic government will be established in Iraq.
Writing in the Washington Post, Lawrence Lessig and Robert McChesney say Congress is about to cast a historic vote on the future of the Internet. It will decide whether the Internet remains a free and open technology, fostering innovation, economic growth, and democratic communication, or instead becomes the property of cable and phone companies that can put toll booths at every on-ramp and exit on the information superhighway. At the center of the debate is network neutrality. Network neutrality means simply that all like internet content must be treated alike and move at the same speed over the network. The owners of the internet's wires cannot discriminate. This is a simple but brilliant end-to-end design of the internet that has made it such a powerful force for economic and social good. All of the intelligence and control is held by producers and users, not the networks that connect them. The protections that guaranteed network neutrality have been law since the birth of the internet, right up until last year, when the Federal Communications Commission eliminated the rules that kept cable and phone companies from discriminating against content providers. This triggered a wave of announcements from phone company chief executives that they plan to do exactly that. Now, Congress faces a legislative decision. Will we reinstate net neutrality and keep the internet free, or will we let it die at the hands of network owners itching to become content gatekeepers? The implications of permanently losing network neutrality could not be more serious. The current legislation, backed by companies such as AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, would allow the firms to create different tiers of online service. They'd be able to sell access to the express lane to deep-pocketed corporations and relegate everyone else to the digital equivalent of a winding dirt road. Worse still, these gatekeepers would determine who gets premium treatment and who doesn't. Without network neutrality, the internet would start to look like cable TV. A handful of massive companies would control access and distribution of content, deciding what you get to see and how much it costs. Major industries such as healthcare, finance, retailing, and gambling would face huge tariffs for fast, secure internet use, all subject to discriminatory and exclusive deal-making with telephone and cable giants. The smell of windfall profits is in the air in Washington. The phone companies are pulling out all the stops to legislate themselves monopoly power. They are spending tens of millions of dollars on inside the beltway print, radio, and TV ads, high-priced lobbyists, coin-operated think tanks, and sham astroturf groups like fake grassroots operations with names or Orwellian names such as Hands Off the Internet and netcompetition.org.
House Republicans yesterday revived their efforts to slash funding for public broadcasting, according to the Boston Globe. A key committee approved a $115 million reduction in the budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that could force the elimination of some popular PBS and NPR programs. On a party-line vote, the House Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees health and education funding approved the cut to the budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB distributes money to the Public Broadcasting Service and National Public Radio. The cut reduces the corporation's budget by 23% next year. Republicans say the action was necessary to rein in government spending. The reduction must be approved by the full Appropriations Committee and then the full House and Senate before it could take effect. Democrats and public broadcasting advocates began planning efforts to reverse the cut. Republicans say they remain adamant that public broadcasting cannot receive funding at the expense of health care and education programs, and of course, America's massively supersized military. This from the Boston Globe.
According to activists from Des Moines, Philadelphia, Miami, Sacramento, and other locations, a young woman named Anna allegedly infiltrated peace and justice rallies and anarchist meetings. Now, she's also alleged to have attempted to join protests against the Democratic National Committee ahead of the DNC's national convention last year as a paid FBI confidential informant. Activists say that she has tried to provoke conflict at various advocacy events and violent incidents with police to get people arrested. In other words, Anna is not just an informant, she may be a provocateur. Although she is known among activist groups as either Anna Davies or Anna Davidson, others know her as Gray Damiani. She focuses her efforts largely on anarchist groups. The FBI claims that Anna has provided information that has been utilized in at least 12 separate anarchist cases and that her information has proved accurate and reliable. But just who is Anna and what makes her reliable? For that matter, how many Annas are there floating around out there? This from Interpress, other sources, independent, and other independent media sources.
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell said yesterday that extending walls along the U.S.-Mexico border will not solve the problem of illegal immigration. Powell said the Berlin Wall did not work perfectly, and the wall that the Israelis are putting up is not going to work perfectly, so a wall alone is not the answer. An immigration measure approved by the U.S. Senate offers illegal immigrants a chance at citizenship while extending fences along the border. The House passed a measure making all immigrants subject to felony charges. Negotiations to reconcile the proposals have yet to begin. Powell, speaking at a business conference in Mexico City, said any new barrier should include gates and other entrances to provide easy access between both countries. He said U.S. authorities should let many of the estimated 12 million undocumented migrants already in America earn some form of legal status through expanded temporary worker programs. This according to The Guardian.
The Senate yesterday rejected Republican efforts to repeal the estate tax, but GOP leaders promised to try again before the election year is over. Senators voted 57 to 41 to advance the bill, but that was three votes short of the 60 needed to overcome objections from a majority of Democrats and two Republicans. Those opposed to the bill said it would deliver an unwise tax cut when the government needed more money to balance its budget and to wage war. Republicans staged the vote knowing they did not have the 60 votes to prevail on repealing the tax, a top priority of many GOP voters. Some of the tax's biggest critics had hoped they could attract a few extra votes by extending a cooperative hand to Democrats. Setting the tax rate for most estates equal to capital gains would put living business and property owners on equal footing with heirs. Republican candidates up for re-election this year can, if nothing else, point to the vote as proof of their support for killing the tax.
Italy's highest appeals court has ruled that calling the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi a buffoon can be actively useful for society. Overruling the conviction of a freelance journalist who hurled insults at the then premier as he left the court 3 years ago, the Court of Cassation acknowledged that the man had leveled strong criticism, but Judge Alfonso Amato argued in a written judgment that it was socially useful in terms of the interest of society as a whole in the expression of opinions. The judge added that a courthouse was the ideal place in which to stimulate reflection on the subject of legality and respect for the law. In May 2003, Patrizio Ricca confronted Berlusconi as he was leaving a trial in Milan, which he was accused of bribing judges to obtain a favorable takeover decision. He was later acquitted. Ricca shouted, "Buffoon! Get yourself convicted!" He compared Berlusconi to Romania's late dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, and was then arrested. This according to The Guardian.
A senior Palestinian official in the Gaza Strip has died in an Israeli airstrike in the town of Rafah. Jamal Abu Samhadana founded the Popular Resistance Committees, which regularly launches homemade rockets into Israel. Samhadana, senior security chief in the Hamas-led government, was one of four killed in the attack on a training camp, which injured seven others. He was one of Israel's most wanted men in Gaza and was thought to be involved in a 2003 attack on a U.S. convoy. A training camp in Rafah on the Egyptian border was shaken by four explosions close to midnight local time. It soon became clear that Samhadana was one of the four killed. The Israeli military confirmed the strike, saying it targeted militants who were planning an attack on Israel. As word of Samhadana's death spread, hundreds of angry militants converged on the hospital where his body was lying. They fired their weapons in the air and swore that they would strike back at Israel. This according to the BBC.
The U.S. has canceled talks in which ministers had been expected to approve urgent measures leading to the payment of Palestinian salaries, including those of the security forces, which were frozen after a Hamas government came to power. A European diplomat said the move reinforced fears that the U.S. was intent on regime change in the Palestinian-ruled territories. Tensions between Hamas and Fatah, forces in Gaza and the West Bank, have been exacerbated by the aid freeze by countries who continue to brand Hamas a terrorist group. The U.S. envoy to the Middle East, David Welch, said there was no basis for talks if they included payment for the security forces. The U.S. has stopped aid, being channeled through Arab banks by warning them of possible penalties. Some diplomats fear that U.S. policy aims to undermine the Hamas government to such an extent that the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, would call new elections in the hope that Hamas loses. The U.S. has canceled talks in which ministers had been expected to approve urgent measures leading to the payment of Palestinian salaries, including those of the security forces, which were frozen after a Hamas government came to power.
Argentina has appealed to the UN's highest court to order Uruguay to halt construction of two paper mills it says will pollute their border river. The Argentine government wants construction stopped to allow further environmental studies to be conducted. Uruguay says the mills will adhere to the strictest rules and bring badly needed jobs to the border area. The row has provoked months of protests and strained traditionally warm ties between the two countries. The International Court of Justice at The Hague is holding an initial 2 days of hearings on whether construction should be frozen, pending further talks and an environmental report. The mills are being built on the Uruguayan side of the river that separates the two South American neighbors. Argentina argues that they will pollute a region dependent on agriculture and tourism. Under a 1975 treaty, all issues concerning the River Uruguay must be agreed by both countries. There have been mass protests in Argentina against the mills, including one in April when thousands blocked traffic crossing the bridge between the two countries. This from the BBC.
The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan defended his top deputies yesterday from sharp U.S. criticism about a speech that faulted Washington's attitude toward the United Nations. Annan told reporters the thrust of the speech from Deputy Secretary General Mark Malik Brown was that the United States and the United Nations need each other. He also warned the U.S. against abandoning efforts to reform the world body because of the remarks. Malik Brown's speech was a rare direct rebuke of the top financial contributor to the U.N. He said the United States relies on the U.N. diplomatically, but refuses to defend it before its critics at home. In a speech in London on Thursday, Bolton repeated his belief that Malik Brown's comment could wreak havoc on efforts to reform the U.N. The back and forth highlighted the often tense relationship between the United States and the UN. The relationship has been further strained since the arrival last year of Bolton, a blunt advocate for U.S. interests who has a penchant for eschewing diplomatic language and speaking plainly about his belief that the United Nations desperately needs reform.
Bomb attacks in Baghdad showed no sign of abating yesterday. Three separate explosions in the Iraqi capital killed at least 31 people with dozens more injured. This from The Guardian. An attack on a police station in the New Baghdad area of in eastern Baghdad killed two policemen and four civilians and wounded 11 other people, including three policemen. That was followed by a blast in the same area shortly after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and U.S. officials announced that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had been killed. Two women were among the 13 who died when the bomb detonated at the entrance to the market, severely damaging shops, police shops and vehicles. A car bomb also exploded in Khadamiya, a Shiite area of northwestern Baghdad, killing 7 people and wounding 17. This again from The Guardian.
The amount of cash the U.S. military has paid to families of Iraqi civilians killed or maimed in operations involving American troops skyrocketed from just under $5 million in 2004 to almost $20 million last year, according to Pentagon financial data. The dramatic spike in what's known as condolence payments suggests that American commanders made on-the-spot restitution far more frequently. Defense Department officials maintain that the payments mirror a local custom commonly known as solatia, in which families receive financial compensation for damages or human losses. They stress that the payments shouldn't be seen as an admission of guilt or responsibility and should not be referred to as silence money. But amid reports that U.S. Marines paid $2,500 per victim after dozens of civilians were killed in the town of Hodeitha, the fourfold increase in condolence payments raises new questions about the extent to which Iraqi civilians have been the victims of U.S. firepower. This from the Boston Globe.
The U.S. military says the house it raided in Ishaki recently held rebels, but neighbors disagree. In the incident, at least 11 people were killed at the home of Faiz Hirat Khalaf, a schoolteacher and beekeeper. Among the dead were a 9-month-old baby, 4 other children younger than 7, and their grandmother. The corpses were riddled with bullet holes, ripped by shrapnel, and coated in dust that rained down when the roof collapsed from explosions. Unlike the Marines accused of slaughtering Iraqi civilians in Haditha, the troops who stormed Ishaqi have been cleared of wrongdoing by U.S. military investigators. The military concluded that the troops in Ishaqi were forced to use heavy firepower after they were shot at from within the house. The dead family was what the military is calling collateral damage. 11 more deaths in a war that has felled thousands of Iraqi civilians. The townspeople characterized the slayings as an atrocity visited upon an innocent family. Some family members said troops tied up their relatives and shot them execution style. This from the LA Times.
And that was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, June 9th. Thanks for listening. The morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartelson and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Becca Bartelson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Jake Wallner.
And I'm Chris Andre.
This weekend's weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy in the morning, then partly sunny, highs 65 to 70. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 50. Saturday and Sunday, partly sunny, high 70 to 75, lows around 50. Coming up this morning on KBOO,